College Basketball Insider.
Some news and notes from around the world of college basketball.
In-studio correspondent for WFAN and CBS Sports Radio.
Attention, please, to John Rothstein. Please report to St. Joe's.
The Insider's Insider.
Joining us now with his thoughts and to break it down, John Rothstein.
It's College Hoops Today with John Rothstein.
Let's put the women and children to bed and go looking for dinner. John Rothstein here on the College Hoops Today podcast. Later in the show, we will be joined by ESPN's Jay Billis. Want to remind you to subscribe to the College Hoops Today podcast on iTunes. We want to be your Bible for the college basketball season and beyond. We are the only college basketball podcast coming to you 52 weeks out of the calendar year. Also, want you to check out the College Hoops Today fan page on Facebook. Give us a like, give us a review, let us know what you think of the product we're bringing to you 52 weeks out of the calendar year. And also, send me your college basketball related questions on Twitter. I'll get to them later in the show. I'm at John Rothstein. That's John, J-O-N. Today's episode of the College Hoops Today podcast is brought to you by Geico. When shopping for car insurance, consider this. Geico has been saving people money on car insurance for over 75 years. So if you're serious about savings, it's simple. Go to geico.com. After 75 years, they know how to save you money. And obviously, throughout the offseason, we have been profiling one major conference each week. Really enjoyed that process, as we always do. But right now, we're getting back to our bread and butter, talking about all the happenings in college basketball on a weekly basis. And we're going to start right now as college basketball starts to become something of a topic that's more on the forefront with Labor Day weekend right now on the horizon. I want to start where we usually start a lot of times on this podcast, and that's with Kentucky. And when you look ahead to next season, obviously one of the top two or three topics, regardless of year, that you're always going to get to when it comes to college basketball is what's going to happen at the University of Kentucky, what's going to happen with John Calipari. Here's what I can tell you. Kentucky is going to have, in my opinion, a big-time learning curve because of what's ahead of them in terms of having minimal experience. The only real player back from last year that had any sort of role on the team that went to the Elite Eight and lost to North Carolina is Wenyen Gabriel. Now, with all that said, John Calipari, once again, has a dynamite recruiting class that is filled with length, that is filled with athleticism, that is filled with, in my opinion, the pieces to make Kentucky a great defensive team. Now, one of the reasons why Kentucky was able to win 38 straight games during the 14-15 season, now this team is completely different than that team because that team had returning players with experience, but one of the reasons why Kentucky was able to dominate that season, okay, was because of how good it was defensively. I think you are going to see, again, a stalwart defensive effort from this Kentucky team. I'm not sure yet about the offense. I am not sure yet what we're going to see at a lead guard position. Is it going to be Kwadi Green, the table-setting point guard from Philadelphia, or is it going to be Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, the 6'5 point guard who initially committed to Florida? These are some of the things that obviously are going to be sorted out over the next 2.5 months. Do they play Kevin Knox at the two and go super big? Do they decide to go with a zone look because they're so long defensively? There's obviously a lot of challenges ahead for Kentucky. The point guard situation, a guy is going to man that spot that doesn't come into college with the one-and-done pedigree of a De'Aaron Fox or a John Wall or a Brandon Knight. Green, Gilgeous-Alexander, good players, different players, but not the known one-and-done commodities that John Calipari has had in the past. And another thing that you have to keep in mind when you look at Kentucky, the state of the SEC. I've written about it in my columns. I've talked about it in my podcast here on a weekly basis. The SEC, in my opinion, is putting itself in a position to get potentially 7 teams in the NCAA tournament in 2018. If you're Kentucky and you're used to being in a situation where, let's be honest, when the SEC over the past couple of years wasn't quite as strong, they could play through mistakes. They could get down in games early and come back because the competition wasn't necessarily always up to par in terms of being able to knock off the Wildcats. That's going to change this year. The SEC is deep, and I think when it's all said and done, you will see 7 teams from this conference in the NCAA tournament. Somebody who's going to be covering a lot of Kentucky and all things college basketball is Jay Billis from ESPN. He makes his inaugural appearance on the College Hoops Today podcast with John Rothstein coming up next. College basketball season inching closer and closer by the second, and our next guest will be at the epicenter of all of it as he continues to be on site and in studio for ESPN. But before Jay Billis can begin to prep for his assignments, he starts every single day with a simple and consistent slogan: I gotta go to work. When did that originate?
Wow, that started years ago. It actually started, I think, right after Michigan State or so, when back when Draymond Green was there. He was listening to some headphones while we were there for game day as they were warming up. And we asked him what he was listening to, and he said Young Jeezy. And it kind of took off from there. It became kind of a Twitter event. And so after I did it a couple of times, it became expected, and then it started to become sort of my morning ritual every morning when I get up. So it kind of took on a life of its own. Jeezy is not all I listen to, but it's among my favorites.
And that is how, obviously, Jay Billis starts every morning on Twitter. And Jay Billis started his national prominence as a basketball player, obviously as a standout high school player in California. And then he went to Duke. But Duke, when you went there, was not the Duke that we know today. I'm curious, what was Mike Krzyzewski like before he became the Mike Krzyzewski that we've seen really evolve into the face of basketball over the last 25 years?
Boy, that's a good question. I don't know that he was all that different in a lot of the most important ways. He was then, and he is now, very genuine. And that's what really sold me on him. I came down to coaches, John, more than schools. And I know, folks at the NCAA probably don't want to hear that because they like to think that you pick the school. But, I was picking coaches. So I came down to Jim Boeheim and Lute Olson, who was at Iowa at the time, and Ted Owens was at Kansas, and then Coach K. And I liked, all of them were great, but I just happened to connect with Coach K at maybe the highest level of all that. And he had probably the fewest credentials at the time. Like he hadn't even been to an NCAA tournament game. In fact, I think my first NCAA tournament game was his first. So, it was a totally different time. But we wound up being awfully good and having a great experience, and it certainly worked out well for him. But it worked out great for me too.
Jay, I've asked this question to Tommy Amaker, and I'm going to ask it to you right now. I'm not saying that you could have obviously predicted that he would go on to become what he's become, but what did you see in being in his presence at such a young age that made you think that, Duke wasn't close to reaching its ceiling as a basketball program?
Well, I don't know that I knew that they were going to be like this, that the program would take off and be like a UCLA-type program or something like that. But I think the quality that he had more than anything was he was relentless, and relentless in preparation, relentless in recruiting. We were going to win, and that was a given, and we were going to do what it took to win. And that's really never changed, I don't think. I mean, I'm not there every day anymore like I was back then, but when I do go to practice and sit on meetings and things like that and watch him do film, it hasn't really changed all that much. His demeanor's changed a little bit. He's more patient. He picks his spots a little bit better, as you would expect. We all get better as we get older. So he's way better of a coach now than when I played for him. But I don't think he's any less passionate or less relentless, if that's a word. He was incredibly relentless in every way of doing what it took to win. And bringing everybody on the same page and getting them to understand that you have to do this for us to win, and you bought into a role that maybe wasn't you didn't expect, but you did it willingly because he required it of you.
And, Jay, you had a great career at Duke. You went on to play professionally overseas, and then from 89 to 92, you were a graduate assistant at Duke, and you were going to law school. What was it like to be at your alma mater during that period when it was really the first couple of times where Duke was right in the mix for a national championship and actually capitalized? I mean, this was really the golden era and the genesis of Duke as we know it.
Yeah, capitalized is the key word there, John, because Duke had been to a number of Final Fours. I mean, my senior year, we were the best team and got clipped in the final by Louisville, and In 88, 89, Duke got to Final Fours with a chance to win, maybe not the best team. And then the 3 years I was a grad assistant there, we went to the NCAA championship game every year. And it was kind of like Disneyland for me, that I got a false sense of security about what coaching was all about. But you'd go to practice every day, and the first, it was the pursuit of the championship. You know, we lost in 90, got beat by UNLV by 30. You know, there's a lot of talk about, Duke being kind of the Minnesota Vikings of college basketball, that unable to win the big one type of deal. And that was following Coach K around. And then when the title was won in 91, when maybe, if you look back, maybe you couldn't have expected that with UNLV being the best team. They were undefeated going into the Final Four. And then winning it the next year when Duke was expected to win, but had to go through that whole Kentucky Leitner shot to do it. I mean, it's really kind of a fragile deal if you look at it that way, that you could have come out of those, that 90, 91, 92. If you look at it, it was pretty close to being over. But if you look at a number of the other championships, championship runs, he could have more. Like you could say, well, Coach K could only have two. Well, he could have nine because there were chances to win them when he had the best team in 99, 86, some other years where he had a team that was worthy of winning and just didn't get it done.
Now, Jay, you were obviously a huge foundation piece for him to build Duke's program. During a three-year period, though, your role changes. You're now a part of the staff. How did your relationship change?
With Coach K?
Yes.
I don't know that it did, John. I mean, it was, I've never called him Mike. I've always called him Coach K since I first met him, and that goes to even today. And it's not some kind of deferential, total respect thing more than anything. It's just that's the way I've always known him. And that, to me, that's his name. it's Coach K. I've never kind of known him as Mike. So when I was a coach, I was there in a different light. I learned so much more as an assistant than I did as a player because my role was different. So I'm in meetings and the game planning that we did was so much more extensive than I understood because he didn't give us everything when we were players. He didn't want to overburden us with too many details so that we were paralyzed by thinking instead of being able to react instinctively. So when I got to look behind the curtain and realized how much went into it, that's when I really, I think, learned even more about basketball. You think as a player, a lot, and maybe you do, but it's not even close to what you learned later on when you spend so much more time preparing for things, preparing for opponents and then dealing with how you're going to play and meet the different challenges that come up every season, no matter whether you're a top-ranked team or a team that's trying to make it there. It's incredibly challenging year to year.
And would you say that your relationship still hasn't changed as you've went from obviously grad assistant to now broadcaster in terms of what's between you and Coach K?
It's changed in that I'm responsible for so much more now. I mean, back then I was a part of the team. I'm not part of the team anymore. And so I think I'm an outsider who's got some inside knowledge, if that makes sense. I may know a little bit more about the inner workings of that program and kind of how things have gone. But I'm an outsider now. And I'm responsible, as you are, for knowing the entire landscape of the game. And so, before when I was a part of the team, I was invested in Duke winning. I'm not invested in that anymore. That's not my issue. That's not my problem, if you want to put it that way. So when I go to a game, whether it's a Duke game or any game, I don't care who wins. I've been doing this long enough, and you have, I just don't care who wins. I go to the games wanting a good game. Not only so that I enjoy it a little bit more, but that people who are watching and we're in the media business, they enjoy watching a close game more than anything. So you kind of root for a close game. But I'm 53 years old right now, and I've been out of I've been out of sort of being on a team or a member of a team for a long time. So it to me, it's second nature that I don't really care who wins anymore. I'm always happy for the team that wins because I know so many people as you do. And you always feel for the team that loses, but every game I go to, there's a winner and a loser. And before, the only one I cared about when I was a player or an assistant, the only one I cared about was us. And now there is no us anymore. I'm not invested like I used to be. So our relationship's definitely changed in that regard.
And, you know, you talk about, you know, obviously you don't care who wins and loses. That's part of obviously being objective as a broadcaster and a journalist. But, you know, like you've mentioned the competitiveness that he has, and that's what's driven him to all this success. This is something I've noticed recently, and you've been around Coach, obviously, much longer than I have, but he is an unbelievable loser. In 2015, Duke beats Wisconsin, okay, to win the national championship. He jumps up and pumps his fist, and then in the same motion, he gathers himself and is a true professional to Bo Ryan. A year earlier, Duke loses to Mercer in Raleigh. He goes into the locker room and congratulates the opposing 14th seed. I mean, Jay, you know, it's part of our business. Unfortunately, it's part of society right now. Schadenfreude is such a big part of our culture. And he, who has 5 national titles and 3 gold medals, exudes the opposite. How does somebody who's such a great winner allow himself to be such a great loser?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's similar to what perhaps Jack Nicklaus was as a golfer when he won so many, won 18 majors, but he also finished second 17 or 18 times, whatever it is. And there's always footage of him with his arm around the winner and saying, "Hey, you know, I gave you my best, and my best wasn't good enough today to congratulate the winner." And I think that's what Coach K has always done, whether it was after the Leitner shot in 92 against Kentucky. You know, that, as you probably remember, that was Kaywood Ledford's last game as a legendary broadcaster. And he went over without being asked. You know, he just had the sense of the empathy to you know, think outside of himself. And he went over and put a headset on and was on the air as Kaywood Ledford went off just to compliment Kentucky on an amazing performance. And you know, he knows that the margin between victory and defeat is a thin one, and times when you win a championship, you could very easily have gone, it could have very easily gone the other way, or times when you've lost, he knows what it's like to lose, and when maybe you should have won, and it's not as black and white or as easy sometimes as we make it seem, but he's always been that way, and I've always admired that. That's really perceptive of you to pick that up.
ESPN's Jay Billis joined the College Hoops Today podcast with John Rothstein. And as we touched upon, Jay was a grad assistant at Duke from 1989 to 1992. Another member of that staff, who a lot of people forget, is Mike Bray, who has built an unbelievable program at Notre Dame. I think a lot of people spend time, and for good reason, talking about your relationship with Coach K. But what is the Jay Billis-Mike Bray relationship like?
Mike was a real mentor of mine. You know, he came to Duke from DeMatha High School, where he had played for Morgan Wooten and had taught and coached under Coach Wooten at DeMatha for many years. And I think it was 1988 was his first year at Duke. And I got to know Mike when he was first hired. And then when I came on the following year, I was still playing overseas. When I came on the following year as a grad assistant, I spent a lot of time in Mike's office. And he really taught me a ton, and still does. And I'm not sure I've met anybody that's got a better sense of what this is all about, a better perspective on things than Mike. He's another relentless competitor, but he's got amazing perspective on things, and he's able to turn things on and off. As soon as the game's over, he's kind of like Coach K in that, you know, he thinks about things way beyond the game. His demeanor is always good. He wants to win as much as anybody. Nobody wants to win more than he does. But he's not going to burden other people with that. In other words, if he loses, you know, he's not going to be some sad sack that ruins everybody's evening. That's not who he is. And he's got you've been around him. Mike's as good a guy as I've ever known. And he's one of the guys that, you know, there are a number of guys out there, but he's one of the guys that boy, if I could have, you can only play for one guy, and I picked the right guy in Coach K. But I would have loved to have played for Mike Bray. He wouldn't have recruited me, but I would have loved to have played for him.
Well, one guy that obviously Duke recruited during that time was Bobby Hurley, who, you know, everybody is, I think, without hesitation saying is the best college point guard that's ever played the game. But Jay, you know, I've seen this more the past couple of years since he's become a Division I head coach. I have never been around anybody as competitive as Bobby Hurley. If there's a tweet that he doesn't like, if there's a story he doesn't like, if he doesn't agree with the power ranking for a certain conference, he is letting you know. If that's what he's like as a coach, I can't imagine what it was like when he was the starting point guard for Duke for 4 years. What was Bobby Hurley like as a player, and what was it like to be around him every day?
He was obviously a great player. You know, I wasn't there when he was recruited, so I had just heard stories about him, and I'd never seen him play in high school. So when he got to Duke, that was my first year as a grad assistant. So I'd heard all these things about Bobby, and I had pictured him a little bit differently. And I had played with Tommy Amaker, who I feel is one of the handful of the greatest point guards in ACC history and beyond. Like, Tommy was a phenomenal player and the best leader I've ever played with. So that was my view of a point guard, what a point guard should be. And Bobby Hurley was not that when he first got to Duke. Very emotional, kind of volatile. So I kind of didn't get it at first. I was like, what's everybody talking about? I mean, he kind of whines a lot. Look at his face, look at his facial expressions after he makes a mistake. The ball's flying all over the place. But after a while, after Coach K got a hold of him, man, he was the real deal. And as you say, very competitive. Emotionally competitive, because I'm learning as I get older. Like, there are different forms of competitiveness. Like, I don't think just because, you know, Bobby gets heated about something somebody says, there are a bunch of guys that do that, but like handle it a different way. So I'm not too worried about all that stuff. He is a relentless competitor, but there are a bunch of those guys and a bunch of people. He just was able to put it into practice. And he never got tired. That was one thing I couldn't believe, that he could run and run and run and never got tired. And that was one of the things that I think made him special beyond just his ability level, was he was relentless in his pursuit defensively of people and his ability to get up and down the floor, because he never got tired. And that was a huge aspect of his game.
And, you know, Bobby obviously graduated in 93. Duke lost to Cal that year, won the national title, most outstanding player of the Final Four in 92 in Minneapolis. Jay, that was your last, obviously, game on the Duke staff. Why not pursue a career in coaching at that point? Why did you opt to go the route that you've taken?
You know, I thought about it. I wanted to stay in coaching, I was getting married. I just got my law degree. And my wife and I were sort of discussing, should I pursue this when we were engaged? And it seemed like for us and the things that we wanted as a family, that coaching might not have been the best way to go about things, simply because, you know how it is. I mean, you have to move every once in a while. And both my wife and I grew up in households where we lived in the same place for, you know, basically our whole lives. And that's what we wanted for our family. And coaching was not going to provide that. And look, if you have to move, we could do that, but we didn't want it. And so I felt like I could do other things. And so I went in another direction, or we went in another direction. There have been times when I've regretted that, or I shouldn't say regretted that. There have been times when I kind of pined for the competitive aspect of coaching, because you go to, I go to all these games, and like we said before, like, I don't think objectivity is that hard. I don't think being fair is hard. So people go, well, how can you go to a Duke game and be objective? Well, because fairness is not hard. But when you leave a game, and I imagine you feel the same way. You know, I've never talked about this when we've been together having dinner or something. But when you leave a game, you didn't win or lose, and so there's none of that competitive feedback. There's no skin in the game of these games for us. It's just, did we do a good job? And that's great, but it's not the same. So I've not had that for a lot of years, and I miss it. I miss kind of being in the middle of it. And that's the one thing that I miss about basketball that I don't get from broadcasting. I do not get the skin in the game, win or lose feeling at the end of every game, which was part of what I loved about playing, and what I loved about coaching, and what I loved about just being in the sport. Is the winning losing part, and you don't get that as a broadcaster.
Do you think that's something eventually you would consider going back to as life progresses, if your children were out of the house or anything like that?
No, my kids are gone. They're my daughter just graduated college, and my son's a junior at Wake Forest this year. I don't think coaching's in the cards. I mean, I've received offers in the past to get back into it. And there were chances to maybe, you know, move up to the NBA and front office stuff. I don't know that that'll ever come around again. If it did, I would certainly, you know, I've never been one that said, hey, no, I'm not going to do this or not going to do that. I would listen to any offer that comes my way. I just think that's smart business. If somebody wants to offer you something, I'll listen. But I'm really happy doing what I'm doing, and I don't have any tremendous ambition to you know, go back into the competitive side of sport. I miss it. I would love to do it again, but I really like what I'm doing now. I mean, I love what I'm doing now. I love the people I work with. So I don't see any reason to do it. But I never say never to a future opportunity. I don't know what the future holds, but what I'm doing now, I don't see any reason to leave it.
Well, and I got to think that things are so much different now from a coaching perspective or recruiting perspective just because of social media. I mean, you know, it's almost like because if a kid has a social media account right now, that when he makes his college decision, he feels like he's entitled to the same rights as LeBron James. How much different have you found kids, and I know you work camps every summer and you're around prospects, do you find kids now versus maybe 25, 30 years ago?
I don't think the players are any different. I don't think the kids are any different. I think we're different. And the environment we have created for them is really different. I watched my son go through it and all his teammates when he was playing AAU basketball, high school basketball. You know, the game has become the college game and the pro game. The money has exploded. And if people think they can stop the flow of money, they can't. We can pretend we can, but we can't. So that's permeated everything. So there's all kinds of things that go on with regard to the summer culture and the tournaments that people play in, things like that, where money's all over the place, shoe companies and all that. So that's changed things. And the players now, they travel more than ever. They play more than ever. I don't know that they necessarily, I think they compete at a higher level than we did. We think we did, but these guys compete at a higher level, younger than we did. So the average player today is better than they've ever been. Now, why we like to say that because of AAU basketball, they don't value winning. I find that laughably absurd because they do. It's like when I was a kid, the coaches complained that we played too much pickup games. We played too many pickup games. And you know, we were with our high school coaches more than anything. And college coaches complained about high school coaches back then and how much influence they had. Now they complain about AAU coaches and how much influence they have. So there's always a complaint. Things are always going to change. But what's changed more than anything is the money around the game. And these players, they have more of a feel for how valuable they are. They know. And they're treated as if they're not valuable, or at least we tell them they're not. And how with all the money in the game and coaches making $5, $6, $7, $8 million a year in college, how we can call unpaid amateurs entitled is beyond me. I mean that burns me more than anything, that we call the unpaid ones entitled, and the ones that are signing these big deals and making all this money, maybe ourselves included. I just find that almost a joke that we do that. Cause I think these guys work really hard. I think they're really talented and they play their tails off. They just play too much. And we're the ones that are putting them in that position. They're not doing it themselves.
Well, that's a perfect segue to my next topic that I want you to hit on. And obviously everybody knows that you're passionate about what's going on, obviously, with student athletes in the NCAA. If I could give you right now three things that you could change right now today with the NCAA, what would they be?
One would certainly be sort of the monetary component of things, that I don't think amateurism does anything for a player. Amateurism doesn't make a college player a better person, a better student, a better athlete. It provides absolutely nothing. So I would open it up. If these players are old enough to sell for billions of dollars, and that's exactly what we're doing, they're old enough to make money from the endeavor. So I would leave it on the schools that the schools make decisions on whether to give scholarships. They make decisions on whom to recruit. They make decisions on their employees every single day. All these schools have 20 plus thousand employees, and they know exactly who to pay and how much. So I would open it up and say, hey, if you don't want to pay, don't pay. But if you want to, it's up to you. So deal with it the way you want, just like you do with any other person, any other student, any other employee. So I would open it up, and amateurism would go by the way. The second thing I would do would be in NCAA enforcement. That I am a rules guy. I believe in rules, and I believe in the enforcement of rules, but I believe in doing it in the right way. And I don't think any reasonable person would set up this Rube Goldberg system that the NCAA has right now for enforcement and adjudication. So I would have all disputes within the NCAA decided by the American Arbitration Association, where the parties, meaning the targeted school and the NCAA, would mutually decide upon arbitrators, and they would present their case before the American Arbitration Association. It would be much faster. The results would be much more reliable. And the AAA does this all the time. They can apply the NCAA's rules to the facts that are presented, and come up with decisions. And the United States Anti-Doping Agency, the United States Olympic Committee, use the AAA. I don't see why the NCAA couldn't do it. And lastly, third, I would the NCAA would be out of eligibility issues with regard to academics. That these schools know exactly how to educate and how to deal with things. There should be no you can have eligibility components as far as you have to have a certain GPA and all that stuff. But initial eligibility would not be up to the NCAA. That the schools would decide who's qualified to be admitted, which they do now, and who's qualified to get a uniform and to play for them. If they want to have, you know, requirements toward graduation, all that stuff, that's great. But that's how they perform in college. How they perform in high school should not be subject to some review by the NCAA, because the clearinghouse, that whole clearinghouse situation is an unholy mess. And frankly, I think it's wrong to the point of almost being immoral. I mean, I paid the NCAA $75 for my kid to get vetted. And I think it's kind of ridiculous that they do that. So those would be probably the top three of many things that I would do if I could wave a magic wand. But sadly, I can't.
ESPN's Jay Billis joined the College Hoops Today podcast with John Rothstein. Well, there's one topic that I want to get your take on. I know that you've been obviously very vocal, and I've read your stuff in the past about not having waivers on transfers, but obviously transfers have become a major part of college basketball. And you know, graduate transfers are an interesting topic because one D1 coach told me, I think the statistic this summer, that less than 25% of graduate transfers actually get their degree. It's obvious why these kids are switching schools. It's from an athletic perspective. Do you think that the sport would be better off if all transfers, graduate included, had to sit a year?
No, but I'd be okay with that. I don't think any transfer should have to sit a year. No other students made to sit out. And if these are students to be treated like any other student, why would we make them sit out? The NCAA makes them sit out because they want to make it a disincentive to transfer. They don't want players leaving because players are assets, and they're not, they don't say that straight out, but that's what they are. They're assets of the university. And so whether they graduate as graduate transfers or not, these guys that are complaining about that, they don't care about that. They just care about losing an asset. They're worried about players being recruited off their teams and all that stuff. Or at least they claim that. Whereas, you know, if you want your players to stay, treat them right, and they'll stay. We shouldn't have to have requirements where they feel like they're disincentivized to transfer or something like that. I look at this as being like a non-compete provision in an employment contract, that they can be told when they can leave. And you know, like you're saying about the waiver issue, there's no way if I want to leave school, or if you wanted to leave Ithaca or something, that the place you're trying to leave gets to tell you where you can go. That's absurd. And you know, I think as long as you finish the year. And I don't mean finish the year at that school, but as long as you sit, when you leave, if you leave it, you know, at Christmas or something, you should be eligible for an entire year the next year. There's no reason you should be able to leave after the completion of the season. Now, should you be able to transfer mid-season and play right away? No, that would be ridiculous. I think reasonable people can agree on that. But, you know, because we're not worried about coaches switching teams at halftime, even though you could make that same argument that people like to make about players. What, do you want to be able to leave and play on the other team at halftime? We can certainly find reasonable solutions to this. But how we can stop unpaid amateur students from going to another school and participating in an extracurricular activity, which is exactly what the NCAA says this stuff is, I find that kind of ridiculous. That we could argue out of both sides of our mouths on this. It's either a big business and their employees and can be subject to a non-compete provision, or they're just students, you know, kind of doing an extracurricular activity like playing in the band and all that stuff. I don't see how we can have it both ways on this, and I don't see that transfers are killing the game. They're just not. It's not that big of a deal. And the players ought to be able to do what's in their interest first if we really believe in student-athlete welfare.
Interesting perspective. Now, you got a lot of perspective from, you know, probably good and bad from all your nights working with Bill Raftery. Other than, you know, other than covering, obviously, the sport without him on Monday nights, what's been the biggest difference doing ACC games versus the old Big East?
Well, there are so many old Big East teams in the ACC. Things have changed so much. I think the Big East, the old Big East, had a grit to it that the current conferences don't have. And it's not to say, like, I played in the ACC when it was an 8-team league. I would challenge anybody to find a better league than the ACC back then. It was the best league. The Big East had some years where it was just as good, if not better, in a given year. But over the course of time, the ACC was the best conference. I think the ACC is still the best league. But the Big East at the time that I was involved in it, that dozen-year period or whatever it was, Big Monday was a happening in that league, and it was ridiculously popular, and those games were unbelievably gritty, and I loved every second of it, and there were personalities. There still are. There are still great personalities, but the leagues have changed such that the rivalries are different. And they're, you know, now it's, you know, Syracuse Duke hasn't reached the same level of rivalry because it hasn't gained the same traction as some of the old rivalries of Georgetown Syracuse. And when those things are gone, you miss them. We'll be fine without them. The game survives and it's just as popular now as it's ever been. But for some of us who are older and remember the way it was, it's not that it's not as good. It's just not the same. And sometimes when things aren't the same, you lament that a little bit. And I think college basketball has had to deal with it, but so has college football. So has pro football. You know, Houston Astros are in the American League now. I mean, you know, who can figure all this stuff out? There's change, but some of the change has been radical, and the loss of the Big East has been one of the most radical changes in college basketball that we've seen.
Well, and change is something that we can obviously guarantee ourselves to have every college basketball season, as we are now roughly 4.5 weeks away from practice officially starting. What are the biggest things you're looking forward to as we get ready to kick off 17-18?
I think the top of college basketball is going to be incredibly strong this year. And I'm looking forward to sort of the teams that have folks coming back. So when you look at Arizona or Michigan State, even Duke now with Marvin Bagley coming in and that amazing recruiting class they have, it's having guys like Grayson Allen and Marquise Bolden coming back that makes it a little bit more powerful. Same thing with Arizona, having Alonzo Trier back and Raleigh Alkins and Ristich, and, you know, Kansas having Devontae Graham back and Udoka Azubuike, all these players. Gerald Vick will be really good. But I think Michigan State will be the most interesting team. And I think Michigan, as good as Duke is, and they could be great, I'm really intrigued to see how good Michigan State is going to be, because I think Michigan State could be kind of Tom Izzo near 2000 good. And if you remember back that far, John, Michigan State at the beginning of the year was expected to be a Final Four team, but I'm not sure during the year they were really thought of as the best team all the way through. That was, you know, Cincinnati, Kenyon Martin, all those guys. But at the end of the year, even with – what's that?
No, I think if memory serves correct, I think Mateen Cleaves broke his foot.
He did, and he was injured, and then when he came back, he actually got injured in the championship game, if I remember right. But, you know, it was one of those things where they could wind up having a year like that again, and maybe by the end of this thing being the best team, even though, you know, we can be distracted. I'm the guilty of this as anybody. Get distracted by how great the freshmen are, when oftentimes it's the returning players that wind up being the ultimate difference. And I think they've got some returning players that that have a chance to really make some noise. You know, everybody's going to think of Miles Bridges, but, you know, Cassius Winston, Nick Ward, all those guys. They've got some guys coming back that are really, really good.
Well, and, you know, that's what's interesting, because it feels like in November and December every year, everybody drools over the freshmen. But even the 2015 Duke team that had obviously a slew of one-and-done guys, you know, Quinn Cook was an invaluable member of that team, and so was Emile Jefferson, especially in the championship game. And in 2012, Kentucky, and again, I know they had the 1 and 2 pick in the draft, had three guys, Terrence Jones, Deron Lamb, who played on a Final Four team the year before.
Exactly. And you know, I agree with that. I do think that I'm not one of those, and I'm not saying you are, but that think we kind of oversell freshmen, because these guys are really good, and they're the next generation of superstars, not only in college, but in the NBA. It's not that they've underperformed. It's just that, you know, having older players is kind of like having a rookie in the NBA. I mean, we talk about rookie of the year, and we'll talk a lot about, you know, Lonzo Ball and all these guys, Markel Fultz, all these guys coming to the NBA, and Ben Simmons coming to the NBA next year, but they're not going to be the difference between winning and losing for these teams. It's the veteran players. So I think you have veterans on any level, you're going to be better. And it's just that the star power is the thing that people are most intrigued by. And players that are coming back now, and everybody's guilty of this, we're not as intrigued by them, because oftentimes we think they came back because they had to. And for most of them, it's true. They came back because they had to. Doesn't mean they're not going to dominate or they're not going to be great players. I don't know how many people were that excited by Frank Mason III at Kansas the last couple of years with him coming back, but he was the best player in college basketball last year. And that can be the difference, and so I'm excited about that, and seeing how guys matured from one year to the next, that maybe were good freshmen last year but had really great summers, and we're going to see significant jumps. So that's always the thing that's really fun for me, is to watch how these guys change from year to year.
Well, Jay, appreciate a couple minutes on a number of different topics. Looking forward to a great season. Hope to see you along the way.
John, appreciate it. It's my favorite podcast. Great to be on it. Thanks for having me.
We'd like to thank ESPN's Jay Billis for joining the College Hoops Today podcast with John Rothstein. I want to remind you to subscribe to the College Hoops Today podcast on iTunes. We want to be your Bible for the college basketball season and beyond. Once again, we are the only college basketball podcast coming to you 52 weeks out of the calendar year. Also, I want to remind you to check out the College Hoops Today fan page on Facebook. Give us a like, give us a review, let us know what you think of the product we're bringing to you 52 weeks out of the calendar year. And today's episode of the College Hoops Today podcast is brought to you by Geico. When shopping for car insurance, consider this. Geico has been saving people money on car insurance for over 75 years, so if you're serious about savings, it's simple. Go to geico.com. After 75 years, they know how to save you money. Now that we've got you all set up with your car insurance needs, let's get to the social media portion of the College Hoops Today podcast. Send me your questions on Twitter. I'm at John Rothstein. That's John, J-O-N. Our first question comes from Chris Freeman, and it's, John, how deep of a tourney run do you think Nevada can make this season? I think it's too early to get into that, Chris. I do think that Nevada has an excellent chance to go back to the NCAA tournament behind a trio of impact transfers, Caleb and Cody Martin, and of course Kendall Stevens, the Martins from NC State, Stevens from Purdue. Our next question is coming from Larry Barkin, and it's, John, how will the Power 5 conferences going to 20-game league schedules affect the AAC, the A-10, and others in non-conference scheduling? Larry, it's a great question. I talked about it in my column this week, and I think what you need to look at right now, if you're a team in the American or the Atlantic 10, is you have to look at real changes to your non-conference schedule if we're going to see, okay, a lot of Power 5 schools play 20-game conference schedules. Now, I reported last week that programs in the Big Ten are preparing to go to 20 league games as early as the 18-19 season. The ACC has already went on record in saying that it will play 20 games during the 19-20 season. If this happens, you are going to see it become more difficult for conferences like the Mountain West, the Atlantic 10, and the American Conference to get more teams in the NCAA tournament. These leagues need to find ways to help themselves out and get more quality games on a regular basis. And this is one thing I will say. If you are a program in one of those conferences, don't wait till the next league meetings to bring it up. Bring it up now. Now, let's get to some nuggets.
Five good nuggets.
Five.
But you were close.
Nugget number one, the Aggies are trending up. Several SEC coaches I talked to this summer believe that Texas A&M will win the league. Why? Texas A&M had 489 total assists to 439 turnovers last season as a team. The ratio should improve dramatically next season with redshirt freshman J.J. Caldwell and Marquette grad transfer Dwayne Wilson. Obviously, this team is stacked and loaded 2-5. Admon Gilder, D.J. Hogue, Robert Williams, and Tyler Davis. Nugget number two, Grayson return. That's Duke's Grayson Allen. How about this? Last year, Grayson Allen had 10 games with 20 or more points. 2 years ago as a sophomore, he had 19. Grayson Allen will become more of a focal point this season than he was last season. Look for him to regain his sophomore form. Nugget number three, Wichita State stepping up a weight class. We knew that, obviously, with the Shockers joining the American Conference. But how about this? From 2013 to 2017, Wichita State had a combined regular season record of 68-4 in conference games. The bar now gets raised for the Shockers in the American. Nugget number four, all eyes on Manek. Who's that? That's Oklahoma freshman Brady Manek. The school announced last week that Christian Doolittle, the expected starting power forward for Oklahoma, will miss the first semester due to academic issues. Keep an eye on Brady Manek. I saw him in Oklahoma practice last month before the Sooners went on their foreign tour in Australia, and I was so impressed by his poise, by his savvy, by his IQ. Reminds me of Aaron White, who played at the University of Iowa for Fran McCaffrey. And nugget number five, some transfer news. San Jose State transfer Brandon Clark will visit Gonzaga on Monday and Tuesday of this week, per source. Also slated to visit Oregon next weekend. Sit one, play two. This is an all-Mountain West first-team caliber player. Averaged 17.5 points, 8.9 rebounds last season. We'd like to thank ESPN's Jay Billis for joining the College Hoops Today podcast with John Rothstein. We'll be back next week. Same bat time, same bat channel, as well as the College Hoops Today podcast with John Rothstein.